Her thoughts seemed to swirl in her head whenever she told herself that sometime close to St. Gregor's Day, she would give birth to a child. She was a little frightened by it, too. She remembered her mother's shrill screams, which had rung out over the farm for 2 days when Ulvil had come into the world. Over at Ulvsvold, 2 young women had died, one after the other, in childbirth. And Sigurd of Lopsgaard's first 2 wives had died, too, and her own grandmother, for whom she was named. But fear was not what she felt most. These past years, when she realized again that she was still not pregnant, she had thought that perhaps this was to be their punishment, hers and Erland's. That she would continue to be barren. They would wait and wait in vain for what they had feared before. They would hope so futilely, just as they had feared so needlessly. Until at last they would realize that one day they would be carried out from his ancestral estate and vanish. His brother was a priest, after all, and the children that Erland already had could never inherit from him. Munon the Stump and his sons would come in and take their place, and Erland would be erased from the lineage. She pressed her hand hard against her womb. It was there, between her and the fence, between her and the vat, between her and the whole world, Erland's legitimate son. She had tried everything she had heard Fru Asshild once speak of, with blood from her right and left arm. She was carrying a son, whatever fate he might bring her. She remembered her brothers who had died, and her parents' sorrowful faces whenever they mentioned them. She remembered all those times when she had seen them in despair over Ulvild, and the night she had died. And she thought about all the sorrow she herself had caused them, and about her father's careworn face. And yet this was not the end of the grief she would bring to her father and mother. And yet. Kristen rested her head on her arm lying along the fence. The other hand she kept pressed against her womb. Even if this brought her new sorrows, even if it caused her own death, she would still rather die giving Erland a son than have them both die someday, with the buildings standing empty, and with the grain in their fields swaying for strangers. Someone came into the front room. The ale, thought Kristen. I should have looked at it long ago. She straightened up. And then Erland stooped as he came out of the doorway and stepped forward into the sunlight, beaming with joy.
So this is where you are, he said. And you don't even take a step to meet me? He asked.
He came over and embraced her. Beloved, have you come to visit? She asked, astonished. He must have just dismounted from his horse. He still had his cape over his shoulders and his sword at his side. He was unshaven, filthy, and covered with dust. He was wearing a red surcoat, which draped from the neckline and was slit up the sides almost to his arms. As they went through the brewhouse and across the courtyard, his clothes fluttered around him so that his thighs were visible clear up to his waist. It was odd. She had never noticed before that he walked slightly crooked. Before, she had only seen that he had long, slender legs and narrow ankles and small, well-shaped feet. Erland had brought a full escort along with him, 5 men and 4 spare horses. He told Ronfrid that he had come to get Kristen's household goods. Wouldn't it be a comfort for her to find her things at Husaby when she arrived? And since the wedding was to take place so late in the fall, it might be more difficult to transport everything then. And wouldn't it be more likely to suffer damage from seawater on the ship? The abbot at Niederholm had offered to send everything now with a Laurentius Cloisters ship. They expected to set sail from Vire around Assumption Day. That was why he had come to convey her things through Ramsdal to the headland. He sat in the doorway to the cookhouse and drank ale and talked, while Ronfrid and Kristen plucked the wild ducks that Lavrans had brought home the day before. The mother and daughter were alone at home. The women servants were all out in the meadows raking. He looked so happy. He was so pleased with himself for coming on such a sensible errand. Her mother left, and Kristen tended to the birds on the spit. Through the open door, she caught a glimpse of Erland's men lying in the shade across the courtyard, passing the basin of ale among them. He sat on the stoop, chatting and laughing. The sun shone brightly on his bare, soot-black hair. She noticed that there were several gray streaks in it. Well, he would soon be 32 after all, but he acted like a brash young man. She knew that she wouldn't tell him about her trouble. There would be time enough for that when he realized it himself. A good-humored tenderness coursed through her heart, over the hard little anger that lay at the bottom, like a glittering river over stones. She loved him more than anything. It filled her heart, even though she always saw and remembered everything else. How out of place this courtier seemed amidst the busy farm work, wearing his elegant red surcoat, silver spurs on his feet, and a belt studded with gold. She also noticed that her father didn't come up to the farm, even though her mother had sent Romborg down to the river with word of the guest who had arrived. Erlon came over to Kristen and put his hands on her shoulders.
"Can you believe it?" he said, his face radiant. "Doesn't it seem strange to you that all these preparations are being made for our wedding?"
Kristen gave him a kiss and pushed him aside. She poured fat over the birds and told him not to get in her way.
No, she wouldn't tell him.
Lavrans didn't come up to the farm until the haymakers did, around supper time. He wasn't dressed much differently from the workmen, in an undyed, knee-length homespun tunic and ankle-length leggings of the same fabric. He was barefoot and carried his scythe over his shoulder. The only thing that distinguished his attire from that of the servants was a shoulder collar of leather for the hawk that was perched on his left shoulder. He was holding Romborg's hand. Lavrans greeted his son-in-law heartily enough and asked his forgiveness for not coming earlier. They had to push as hard as they could to get the farm work done because he had to make a journey into town between the haying season and the harvest. But when Erlan presented the reason for his visit at the supper table, Lavrans became quite cross. It was impossible for him to do without any of his wagons or horses right now. Erlan replied that he had brought along 4 extra horses himself. Lavrans thought there would be at least 3 cartloads. Besides, the maiden would have to keep all her clothing at Urengard, and the bed linen that Kristen would be taking with her would be needed at the farm during the wedding for all the guests they would have to house.
"Never mind," said Erlan.
Surely they would find a way to transport everything in the fall. But he had been so pleased, and he thought it sounded so sensible when the abbot had suggested that Kristen's things might travel with the monastery's ship. The abbot had reminded him of their kinship.
"That's something they're all remembering now," said Erlan with a smile.
His father-in-law's disapproval did not seem to affect him in the least. And so it was decided that Erlan should borrow a wagon and take a cartload of those things that Kristen would need most when she arrived at her new home. The next day they were busy with the packing. Ronfrid thought that both the large and the small looms could be sent along now. She wouldn't have time to weave anything else before the wedding. The mother and daughter cut off the weaving that was on the loom. It was an undyed homespun fabric, but of the finest and softest wool, with tufts of black wool woven in to form a pattern. Kristen and her mother rolled up the cloth and placed it in a leather bag. Kristen thought it would be good for swaddling clothes, and it would be pretty with red or blue ribbons around it. The sewing chest that Arna had once made for her could also go along. Kristen took from her box all the things that Erland had given her over time. She showed her mother the blue velvet cape with the red pattern that she was going to wear in the bridal procession. Her mother turned it this way and that, feeling the fabric and the fur lining.
"This is a most costly cloak," said Ronfrid. "When did Erland give this to you?"
"He gave it to me while I was at Nonnesetter," her daughter told her.
Kristen's bridal chest, which her mother had been adding to ever since she was little, was repacked. It was carved in panels, and on each there was a leaping deer or a bird sitting amidst the foliage. Ronfrid placed Kristen's bridal gown in one of her own chests. It was not quite done. They had been sewing on it all winter long. It was made of scarlet silk
and cut in such a fashion that it would fit snugly to her body. Kristen thought that now it would be much too tight across her breasts. Toward evening, the load was all packed and tied under the wagon's cover. Erlan would leave early the next morning. He stood with Kristen, leaning over the farm gate, looking north, where the bluish-black smudge of a storm cloud filled the valley. Thunder rumbled from the mountains, but to the south, the meadows and the river lay in dazzling yellow sunlight. "Do you remember the storm on that day in the forest near Gerderu?" he asked softly, playing with her fingers. Kristen nodded and tried to smile. The air was so heavy and sultry. Her head was aching and she was sweating with every breath she took. Lavrans came over to them at the gate and talked about the weather. It seldom did any harm down here in the village, but God only knew whether it would bring trouble to the cattle and horses up in the mountains. It was as black as night up behind the church on the hill. A flash of lightning revealed a group of horses, crowding together restlessly, on the meadow outside the church gate. Lavrans didn't think they belonged there in the valley. The horses were more likely from Dovre, and had been wandering in the mountains up beneath Yeta. He shouted over the thunder that he had a mind to go up and see to them, to find out whether there were any of his among them. A terrible bolt of lightning ripped through the darkness up there. Thunder crashed and roared, so they could hear nothing else. The horses raced across the grass beneath the ridge. All three of them crossed themselves. Then more lightning flashed. The sky seemed about to split in half, and a tremendous snow-white bolt of lightning hurtled down toward them. All three were thrown against each other. They stood there with their eyes closed, blinded, and noticed a smell like scorched stone. And then the crash of thunder exploded in their ears.
"Saint Olaf, help us," murmured Lavrans.
"Look at the birch! Look at the birch!" cried Erlan. The huge birch out in the field seemed to wobble, and then a heavy limb broke off and dropped to the ground, leaving a long gash in the trunk.
"I think it's burning. Jesus Christus, the church roof is on fire!" shouted Lavrans.
They stood there and stared. No. Yes, it was. Red flames were flickering out of the shingles beneath the ridge turret. Both men set off running, back across the farmyard. Lavrans tore open all the doors to the buildings, yelling to those inside. Everyone came rushing out.
"Bring axes, bring axes, the felling axes," he shouted, "and the pickaxes."
He raced over to the stables. A moment later he reemerged, leading Guldsvein by his mane. He leaped up onto the unsaddled horse and tore off toward the north. He had the big broad axe in his hand. Erlan rode right behind him, and all the other men followed. Some were on horseback, but others couldn't control the frightened animals and gave up and set off running. Behind them came Rongfrid and the women of the farm with basins and buckets. No one seemed to notice the storm any longer. In the flash of the lightning, they saw people come streaming from the buildings farther down in the village. Sira Eirik was already running up the hill, followed by his servants. Horse hooves thundered across the bridge below, and several farmhands raced past. They all turned their pale, terrified faces toward the burning church. A light wind was blowing from the southeast. The fire was firmly entrenched in the north wall. On the west side, the entrance was already blocked, but it had not yet seized the south side or the apse. Kristen and the women from Jorundgard entered the churchyard south of the church, at a place where the gate had collapsed. The tremendous red blaze lit up the grove north of the church and the area where posts had been erected for tying up the horses. No one could approach the spot because of the heat. Only the cross stood there, bathed in the glow of the flames. It looked as if it were alive and moving. Through the roaring and seething of the fire, they could hear the crash of axes against the staves of the south wall. There were men on the gallery, slashing and chopping, while others tried to tear down the gallery itself. Someone shouted to the women from Jorundgard that Lavrans and a few other men had followed Sira Eirik into the church. They had to break an opening in the wall,
Little tongues of fire were playing here and there among the shingles on the roof. If the wind changed or died down altogether, the flames would engulf the whole church. Any thought of extinguishing the blaze was futile. There was no time to form a chain down to the river, but at Ronfried's command, the women took up positions and passed water from the small creek running along the road to the west. At least there was a little water to throw on the south wall and on the men who were toiling there. Many of the women were sobbing as they worked, out of fear and anguish for those who had gone inside the burning building, and out of sorrow for their church. Kristen stood at the very front of the line of women, throwing the water from the buckets. She stared breathlessly at the church, where they had both gone inside, her father and Erlon. The posts of the gallery had been torn down and lay in a heap of wood amid pieces of shingle from the gallery's roof. The men were chopping at the stave wall with all their might. A whole group had lifted up a timber and was using it as a battering ram. Erlon and one of his men came out of the small south door of the choir. They were carrying between them the large chest from the sacristy, the chest that Eirik usually sat on when he heard confession. Erlon and the servant tipped the chest out into the churchyard. Kristen didn't hear what he shouted. He ran back, up onto the gallery again. He was as lithe as a cat as he dashed along. He had thrown off his outer garments and was dressed only in his shirt, pants, and hose. The others took up his cry. The sacristy and choir were burning. No one could go from the nave up to the south door anymore. The fire was now blocking both exits. A couple of staves in the wall had been splintered, and Erlon had picked up a fire axe and was slashing and hacking at the wreckage of the staves. They had smashed a hole in the side of the church, while other people were shouting for them to watch out. The roof might collapse and bury them all inside the church. The shingled roof was now burning briskly on this side, too, and the heat was becoming unbearable. Erlon leaped through the hole and helped to bring Sira Eirik out. The priest had his robes full of holy vessels from the altars. A young boy followed with his hand over his face, and the tall processional cross held out in front of him. Lavrans came next. He had closed his eyes against the smoke, staggering under the heavy crucifix he held in his arms. It was much taller than he was. People ran forward and helped them move down to the churchyard. Sira Eirik stumbled, fell to his knees, and the altar vessels rolled across the slope. The silver dove opened, and the host fell out. The priest picked it up, brushed it off, and kissed it as he sobbed loudly. He kissed the gilded man's head which had stood above the altar with a scrap of St. Olav's hair and nails inside. Lavrans Bjørgulfsson was still standing there, holding the crucifix. His arm lay across the arms of the cross, and he was leaning his head on the shoulder of Christ. It looked as if the Savior were bending his beautiful, sad face toward the man to console him. The roof had begun to collapse bit by bit on the north side of the church. A blazing roof beam shot out and struck the great bell in the low tower near the churchyard gate. The bell rang with a deep, mournful tone, which faded into a long moan, drowned out by the roar of the fire. No one had paid any attention to the weather during all the tumult. The whole event had not taken much time, but no one was aware of that either. Now the thunder and lightning were far away, to the south of the valley. The rain, which had been falling for a while, was now coming down harder, and the wind had ceased. But suddenly, it was as if a sail of flames had been hoisted up from the foundation. In a flash and with a shriek, the fire engulfed the church from one end to the other. Everyone dashed away from the consuming heat. Erlon was suddenly at Kristen's side and urging her down the hill. His body reeked with the stench of the fire. She pulled away a handful of singed hair when she stroked his head and face. They couldn't hear each other's voices above the roaring of the flames, but she saw that his eyebrows had been scorched right off. He had burns on his face, and his shirt was burned in places too. He laughed as he pulled her along after the others. Everyone followed behind the weeping old priest and Lavrans Bjørgulfsson, carrying the crucifix. At the edge of the churchyard, Lavrans leaned the cross against a tree and then sank down onto the wreckage of the gate. Sira Eirik was already sitting there. He stretched out his arms toward the burning church.
Farewell. Farewell, Olav's church. God bless you, my Olav's church. God bless you for every hour I have spent inside you, singing and saying the Mass. Olav's church, good night, good night.
Everyone from the parish wept loudly along with him. The rain was pouring down on the people huddled together, but no one thought of leaving. It didn't look as if the rain were damping the heat in the charred timbers. Fiery pieces of wood and smoldering shingles were flying everywhere. A moment later, the ridge turret fell into the blaze with a shower of sparks rising up behind it. Lavran sat with one hand covering his face. The other arm lay across his lap, and Kristen saw that his sleeve was bloody from the shoulder all the way down. Blood was running along his fingers. She went over and touched his arm.
I don't think it's serious. Something fell on my shoulder, he said, looking up.
He was so pale that even his lips were white.
Ulfild,
he whispered with anguish as he gazed at the inferno. Sira Eirik heard him and placed a hand on his shoulder.
It will not wake your child, Lavrans.
She will sleep just as soundly with a fire burning over her resting place, he said. She has not lost the home of her soul, as the rest of us have this evening. Kristen hid her face against Erlan's chest. She stood there, feeling his arms around her. Then she heard her father ask for his wife. Someone said that out of terror, a woman had started having labor pains. They had carried her down to the parsonage, and Ronfrid had gone along. Kristen was suddenly reminded of what she had completely forgotten ever since they realized that the church was on fire. She shouldn't have looked at it. There was a man south of the village who had a red splotch covering half his face. They said he was born that way because his mother had looked at a fire while she was carrying him.
Dear Holy Virgin Mary, she prayed in silence, don't let my unborn child be harmed by this.
The next day, a village ting was to be convened on the church hillside. The people would decide on how to rebuild the church. Kristen sought out Sira Eirik up at Romengard before he left for the ting. She asked the priest whether he thought she should take this as an omen. Perhaps it was God's will that she should tell her father she was unworthy to stand beneath the bridal crown, and that it would be more fitting for her to be married to Erlan Nikolausen without a wedding feast. But Sira Eirik flew into a rage, his eyes flashing with fury. Do you think God cares so much about the way you sluts surrender and throw yourselves away that he would burn down a beautiful and honorable church for your sake? Rid yourself of your pride, and do not cause your mother and Lavrans a sorrow from which they would scarcely recover. If you do not wear the crown with honor on your wedding day, it will be bad enough for you. But you and Erlan are in even greater need of this sacrament as you are joined together. Everyone has his sins to answer for. No doubt that is why this misfortune has been brought upon us all. Try to better your life, and help us to rebuild this church. Both you and Erlan. Kristen thought to herself that she had not yet told him of the latest thing that had befallen her, but she decided to let it be. She went to the ting with the men. Lavrans attended with his arm in a sling, and Erlan had numerous burns on his face. He looked so ghastly, but he only laughed. None of the wounds was serious, and he said that he hoped they wouldn't disfigure him on his wedding day. He stood up after Lavrans and promised to give to the church 4 marks of silver, and to the village, on behalf of his betrothed and with Lavrans' consent, a section of Kristen's property worth 1 mark in land tax. Erlan had to stay at Urengard for a week because of his wounds. Kristen saw that Lavrans seemed to like his son-in-law better after the night of the fire. The men now seemed to be quite good friends. Then she thought that perhaps her father might be so pleased with Erlan Nikolausen that he would be more forbearing and not take it as hard as she had feared
when one day he realized that they had sinned against him. Chapter 8. That year was an unusually good one in all the valleys of the north. The hay was abundant, and it was all safely harvested. Everyone returned home from the mountain pastures with fattened livestock and great quantities of butter and cheese, and they had been mercifully free of predators that year. The grain stood so high that few people could remember ever seeing it look so fine. The crops ripened well and were bounteous, and the weather was the best it could be. Between St. Bartholomew's Day and the Feast of the Birth of Mary, during the time when frosty nights were most likely, it rained a little, and the weather was warm and overcast. But after that, the harvest month proceeded with sunshine and wind and mild, hazy nights. By the week after Michaelmas, most of the grain had been brought in throughout the valley. At Urengard, they were toiling and preparing for the great wedding. For the past 2 months, Kristin had been so busy from morning to night, every single day, that she had had little time to worry about anything but her work. She could see that her breasts had grown heavier, and that her small pink nipples had turned brown and were as tender as wounds every morning when she had to get out of bed in the cold. But the pain passed as soon as she warmed up from her work, and then she thought only of what she had to do before nightfall. Sometimes when she straightened up to stretch out her back and paused to rest for a moment, she would notice that what she was carrying in her womb was growing heavy. But she was still just as slender and trim in appearance. She smoothed her hands over her long, fine hips. No, she didn't want to worry about it now. At times she would suddenly think, with a prickling sense of longing, that in a month or two she would be able to feel life inside her. By that time she would be at Husaby. Maybe Erlan would be pleased. She closed her eyes and bit down on her betrothal ring. She saw Erlan's face pale with emotion when he stood up in the high loft and spoke the betrothal vows in a loud, clear voice.
As God is my witness, along with these men who stand before me, I, Erlan Nikolausen, promise myself to Kristin Lavran's daughter in accordance with the laws of God and men, on such conditions as have been presented to these witnesses who stand here with us, that I shall possess you as my wife, and you shall possess me as your husband as long as we both shall live, that we shall live together in matrimony with all such communion as God's laws and the laws of the land acknowledge.
She was running errands across the courtyard, going from building to building, and she stopped for a moment. The mountain ash was full of berries this year. It would be a snowy winter. And the sun was shining over the pale fields, where the sheaves of grain stood piled on poles. If only the weather would hold until the wedding.
Lavrans held firm to his intention that his daughter should be married in a church. It was therefore decided that this would take place in the chapel at Sundbu.
On Saturday, the bridal procession would ride over the mountains to Voga. They would stay the night at Sundbu and the neighboring farms, and then ride back on Sunday after the wedding mass. On the same evening after Vespers, when the Sabbath was over, the wedding would be celebrated and Lavrans would give his daughter away to Erlan. And after midnight, the bride and groom would be escorted to bed. On Friday, in the afternoon, Kristin was standing on the gallery of the high loft, watching the travelers who came riding from the north, past the burned church on the hill. It was Erlan with all his groomsmen. She strained to distinguish him from the others. They were not allowed to see each other. No man could see her until she was led out in the morning, wearing her bridal clothes. At the place where the road turned toward Urengard, several women pulled away from the group. The men continued on toward Laugarbru, where they would spend the night. Kristin went downstairs to welcome the guests. She felt so tired after her bath, and her scalp ached terribly. Her mother had rinsed her hair in a strong lye solution to give it a bright sheen for the next day. Fru Asild Gautisdottir slipped down from her saddle into Lavran's arms.
How lissome and young she keeps herself, thought Kristen. Her daughter-in-law, Katrin, Sir Munon's wife, almost looked older than she did. She was tall and stout, her eyes and skin colorless. It's strange, thought Kristen, that she's ugly and he's unfaithful. And yet people say that they get on well together. Two of Sir Bard Peterson's daughters had also come, one of them married, the other not. They were neither ugly nor beautiful. They looked trustworthy and kind, but seemed quite reserved with strangers. Lavrans thanked them courteously for their willingness to honor this wedding and for making the long journey so late in the fall. Erlan was raised by our father when he was a boy, said the older sister, and she stepped forward to greet Kristen. Then two young men came trotting briskly into the courtyard. They leaped from their horses and ran laughing toward Kristen, who dashed into the house and hid. They were Trond Yesling's young sons, handsome and promising boys. They brought with them the bridal crown from Sundbu in a chest. Trond and his wife wouldn't come to Jurengard until Sunday after the mass. Kristen had fled to the hearthroom, and Fru Asshild had followed. She placed her hands on Kristen's shoulders and pulled her face down to her own for a kiss. I'm glad that I shall see this day, said Fru Asshild. She noticed as she held Kristen's hands how gaunt they had become. She saw that the bride had also grown thin, but her bosom was full. All the lines of her face had become leaner and more delicate than before. In the shadow of her thick, damp hair, her temples seemed slightly hollowed. Her cheeks were no longer round, and her fresh complexion had faded. But Kristen's eyes had grown much larger and darker. Fru Asshild kissed her again. I see you've had much to struggle with, Kristen, she said. I'll give you something to drink tonight, so you'll be rested and fresh in the morning. Kristen's lips began to quiver. Hush, said Fru Asshild, patting her hand. I'm looking forward to dressing you in your finery. No one will ever see a lovelier bride than you shall be tomorrow. Lavrans rode over to Laugarbru to dine with his guests who were staying there. The men could not praise the food enough. A better Friday supper could not be had even in the richest cloister. There was rye flour porridge, boiled beans, and white bread. And the fish that was served was trout, both salted and fresh, and long strips of dried halibut. Gradually, as they helped themselves to the ale, the men became more and more boisterous, and their teasing of the bridegroom became more and more vulgar. All of Erlan's groomsmen were much younger than he was. His own peers and friends had all become married men long ago. Now the men joked about the fact that he was so old and would lie in the bridal bed for the first time. Some of Erlan's older kinsmen, who were still rather sober, were afraid that with each new word uttered, the talk might shift to subjects that would be better left untouched. Sir Bard of Hestness kept an eye on Lavrans. He was drinking heavily, but it didn't look as if the ale was making him any happier as he sat there in the high seat. His face grew more and more tense as his gaze grew stonier. But Erlan, who was sitting to the right of his father-in-law, parried the teasing merrily and laughed a good deal. His face was red and his eyes sparkled. Suddenly Lavrans bellowed, That wagon, son-in-law. While I think of it, what did you do with a wagon that you borrowed from me this past summer?
Wagon? Said Erlan.
Don't you remember that you borrowed a wagon from me last summer? God knows it was a good wagon. I'll probably never see a better one, because I was here myself when it was built on this farm. You promised, and you swore, as I can testify before God. And my house servants can verify that you promised you would bring it back to me, but you haven't kept your word.
Some of the guests shouted that this was nothing to talk about right now, but Lavrans pounded on the table and swore that he would find out what Erlan had done with his wagon.
Oh, it's probably still at the farm on the headland, where we took the boat out to Veyr, said Erlan indifferently. I didn't think it was so important. You see, father-in-law, it was a long and arduous journey with the cartload through the valleys, so by the time we reached the fjord,
None of my men had a mind to travel the whole way back with the wagon and then over the mountains north to Nidaros. So I thought it could wait for the time being. No. May the devil seize me right here where I'm sitting, if I've ever heard the likes of this.
Lavrans interrupted him.
What kind of people do you employ in your household? Is it you or your men who decide where they will or will not go?
Erlon shrugged his shoulders.
It's true that many things have not been as they should be in my home. The wagon will be sent back south to you when Kristen and I journey that way.
My dear father-in-law, he said with a smile, putting out his hand,
you must know that now everything will be different, and I will be too, now that Kristen will be coming home as my wife. The matter of the wagon was unfortunate, but I promise you, this will be the last time you shall have reason to complain about me.
Dear Lavrans, said Bard Pettersen, reconcile yourself with him over this paltry matter.
A paltry matter, or a great one, began Lavrans.
But then he stopped himself and shook hands with Erlon. Soon afterward he left, and the guests at Laugarbrew went to find their beds for the night. On Saturday before noon, the women and maidens were busy in the old loft. Some were making up the bridal bed, while others were helping the bride to finish dressing. Ronfrid had chosen this building for the bridal house because it was the smallest of the lofts. They could house many more guests in the new loft over the storeroom, and it was the bedchamber they had used themselves in the summertime when Kristen was small, before Lavrans had built the high loft house, where they now lived both summer and winter. But the old storehouse was undoubtedly also the loveliest building on the farm, ever since Lavrans had had it rebuilt. It had been in a state of disrepair when they moved to Jorungard. It was now decorated with the most beautiful carvings both inside and out, and the loft was not large, so it was easier to adorn it with tapestries and weavings and pelts. The bridal bed had been made ready with silk-covered pillows, and lovely blankets had been hung all around as draperies. Over the furs and woolen blankets had been spread an embroidered silk coverlet. Ronfrid and several women were hanging tapestries up on the timbered walls and placing cushions on the benches. Kristen was sitting in an armchair that had been carried up to the loft. She was wearing her scarlet bridal gown. Large brooches held it together at her breast and closed the yellow silk shift at the neck. Golden armbands gleamed on the yellow silk sleeves. A gilded silver belt had been wrapped three times around her waist, and around her neck and on her bosom lay necklace upon necklace, and on top of them all lay her father's old gold chain with the large reliquary cross. Her hands, which lay in her lap, were heavy with rings. Fru Asild was standing behind her chair, brushing out Kristen's thick, golden brown hair.
Tomorrow you will wear it loose for the last time, she said with a smile, winding around Kristen's head the red and green silk cords that would support the crown.
Then the women gathered around the bride. Ronfrid and Hiri of Skog brought over from the table the great bridal crown of the Yesling family. It was completely gilded. The tips alternated between crosses and clover leaves, and the circlet was set with rock crystals. They pressed it down onto the bride's head. Ronfrid was pale, and her hands shook as she did this. Kristen slowly rose to her feet. Jesus, how heavy it was to bear all that silver and gold. Then Fru Asild took her by the hand and led her forward to a large water basin, while the bridesmaids threw open the door to let in the sun and brighten up the loft.
Look at yourself now, Kristen, said Fru Asild.
And Kristen bent over the basin. She saw her own face rise up, white, from the water. It came so close that she could see the golden crown above. So many light and dark shadows played all around her reflection. There was something she was just about to remember. And suddenly she felt as if she would faint away. She gripped the edge of the basin. Then Fru Asild placed her hand on top of hers and dug in her nails so hard that Kristen came to her senses. The sound of the lure horns came from the bridge.
People shouted from the courtyard that now the bridegroom had arrived with his entourage. The women led Kristen out onto the gallery. The courtyard was swarming with horses, magnificently bridled, and people in festive dress. Everything glittered and gleamed in the sun. Kristen stared past everything, out toward the valley. Her village lay bright and still beneath a thin, hazy blue mist, and out of the mist towered the mountains, gray with scree and black with forests, and the sun poured its light down into the basin of the valley from a cloudless sky. She hadn't noticed it before, but all the leaves had fallen from the trees, and the groves shone silver-gray and naked. Only the alder thicket along the river still had a little faded green in the crowns of the trees, and a few birches held on to some pale yellow leaves at the very tips of their branches. But the trees were almost bare, except the mountain ash, which was still shining with brownish-red foliage surrounding the blood-red berries. In the still, warm day, the acrid smell of autumn rose up from the ash-colored blanket of fallen leaves spread all around. If not for the mountain ash trees, it might have been springtime, except for the silence, because it was autumn quiet, so quiet. Every time the lure horns ceased, no sound was heard from the village but the clinking of bells from the fallow and harvested fields where the cattle were grazing. The river was small and low, and it flowed so quietly. It was nothing more than tiny currents trickling between the sandbars and the heavy shoals of white stones worn smooth. No streams rushed down the slopes. It had been such a dry autumn. There were glints of moisture all over the fields, but it was only the dampness that always seeped up from the earth in the fall, no matter how hot the day or how clear the sky. The throng of people down in the courtyard parted to make way for the bridegroom's entourage. The young groomsmen rode forward. There was a ripple of excitement among the women on the gallery. Fru Asshild was standing next to the bride. "Be strong now, Kristen," she said. "It won't be long before you are safely under the wimple of a married woman." Kristen nodded helplessly. She could feel how terribly pale her face was. "I'm much too pale a bride," she murmured. "You are the loveliest bride," replied Asshild. "And there's Erlang. It would be hard to find a more handsome pair than the two of you." Erlang rode forward beneath the gallery. He leaped from his horse, agile and unhampered by the heavy drapery of his clothing. Kristen thought he was so handsome that her whole body ached. He was dressed in dark attire, a silk surcoat, pale brown interwoven with a black and white pattern, ankle length and slit at the sides. Around his waist he wore a gold-studded belt, and on his left hip a sword with gold on the hilt and scabbard. Over his shoulders hung a heavy, dark blue velvet cape, and on his black hair he wore a black French silk cap, which was shirred like wings at the sides, and ended in two long streamers, one of which was draped across his chest from his left shoulder, and then thrown back over the other. Erlang greeted his bride, went over to her horse, and stood there with his hand on the saddle bow as Lavrans climbed the stairs. Kristen felt so odd and dizzy faced with all this splendor. Her father seemed a stranger in the formal green velvet surcoat that reached to his ankles. But her mother's face was ashen white beneath the wimple she wore with her red silk dress. Ronfrid came over and placed the cloak around her daughter. Then Lavrans took the bride's hand and led her down to Erlang, who lifted her up onto her horse and then mounted his own. They sat there side by side, in front of the bridal loft, as the procession began to pass through the farm gates. First the priests, Sira Eirik and Sira Tormod from Ulvsvold, and a brother of the cross from Hamar, who was a friend of Lavrans. Next came the groomsmen and the maidens, two by two. And then it was time for Erlang and Kristen to ride forward. After them followed the bride's parents, kinsmen, friends, and guests in long lines, riding between the fences out to the village road. A long stretch of the road was strewn with clusters of mountain ash berries, spruce boughs, and the last white chamomile blossoms of the autumn. People stood along the road as the procession passed, greeting it with cheers. On Sunday, just after sundown, the mounted procession returned to Urengard. Through the first patches of twilight, the bonfires shone red from the courtyard of the bridal farm. Musicians and fiddlers sang and played their drums and fiddles as the group rode toward the warm red glow. Kristen was about to collapse when Erland lifted her down from her horse in front of the gallery to the high loft.
"I was so cold crossing the mountain," she whispered. "I'm so tired."
She stood still for a moment. When she climbed the stairway to the loft, she swayed on every step. Up in the high loft, the frozen wedding guests soon had the warmth restored to their bodies. It was hot from all the candles burning in the room. Steaming hot food was served, and wine and mead and strong ale were passed around. The din of voices and the sounds of people eating droned in Kristen's ears. She sat there, unable to get warm. Her cheeks began to burn after a while, but her feet refused to thaw out, and shivers of cold ran down her spine. All the heavy gold forced her to lean forward as she sat in the high seat at Erland's side. Every time the bridegroom drank a toast to her, she had to look at the red blotches and patches that were so evident on his face now that he was warming up after the ride in the cold air. They were the marks of the burns from that summer. A terrible fear had come over her the evening before, while they were at dinner at Sundbu, when she felt the vacant stare of Bjørn Gunnarsson on her and Erland, eyes that did not blink and did not waver. They had dressed Herr Bjørn in knight's clothing. He looked like a dead man who had been conjured back to life. That night she shared a bed with Fru Asiel, who was the bridegroom's closest kinswoman. "What's the matter with you, Kristen?" asked Fru Asiel a little impatiently. "You must be strong now and not so despondent."
"I'm thinking about all the people we have hurt so that we could live to see this day," said Kristen, shivering.
"It wasn't easy for you two either," said Fru Asiel. "Not for Erlon. And I imagine it's been even harder for you."
"I'm thinking about those helpless children of his," said the bride in the same tone as before. "I wonder whether they know that their father is celebrating his wedding today."
"Think about your own child," said Fru Asiel. "Be glad that you're celebrating your wedding with the one who is the father."
Kristen lay still for a moment, helplessly dizzy. It was so pleasant to hear it mentioned. What had occupied her mind every single day for 3 months or more, though she hadn't been able to breathe a word about it to a living soul. But this helped her for only a moment.
"I'm thinking about the woman who had to pay with her life because she loved Erlang," she whispered, trembling.
"You may have to pay with your own life before you're half a year older," said Fru Asiel harshly. "Be happy while you can."
"What should I say to you, Kristen?" the old woman continued, in despair. "Have you lost all your courage?
The time will come soon enough when the two of you will have to pay for everything that you've taken. Have no fear of that."
But Kristen felt as if one landslide after another were ravaging her soul. Everything was being torn down that she had built up since that terrifying day at Haugen. During those first days, she had simply thought, wildly and blindly, that she had to hold out. She had to hold out one day at a time. And she had held out until things became easier. Quite easy, in the end, when she had cast off all thoughts except one. That now their wedding would take place at last. Erland's wedding at last. She and Erland knelt together during the wedding mass. But it was all like a hallucination. The candles, the paintings, the shining vessels, the priests dressed in linen albs and long chasubles. All those people who had known her in the past seemed like dream images as they stood there filling the church in their unfamiliar festive garb. But Herr Bjørn was leaning against a pillar and looking at them with his dead eyes, and she thought that the other dead one must have come back with him, in his arms. She tried to look up at the painting of St. Olaf. He stood there,
pink and white and handsome, leaning on his axe, treading his own sinful human form underfoot. But Herr Bjorn drew her eyes, and next to him, she saw Elena Ormsdottir's dead countenance. She was looking at them with indifference. They had trampled over her in order to get here, and she did not begrudge them that. She had risen up and cast off all the stones that Kristen had striven so hard to place over the dead. Erland's squandered youth, his honor and well-being, the good graces of his friends, the health of his soul. The dead woman shook them all off. He wanted me, and I wanted him. You wanted him, and he wanted you, said Elena. I had to pay, and he must pay, and you must pay when your time comes. When the sin is consummated, it will give birth to death. Kristen felt that she was kneeling with Erland on a cold stone. He knelt with the red singed patches on his pale face. She knelt beneath the heavy bridal crown and felt the crushing, oppressive weight in her womb, the burden of sin she was carrying. She had played and romped with her sin, measuring it out as if in a child's game. Holy Virgin, soon it would be time for it to lie fully formed before her, looking at her with living eyes, revealing to her the brands of her sin, the hideous deformity of sin, striking hatefully with misshapen hands at his mother's breast. After she had borne her child, after she had seen the marks of sin on him and loved him the way she had loved her sin, then the game would be played to the end. Kristen thought, what if she screamed now, so that her voice pierced through the song and the deep, droning male voices and reverberated out over the crowd? Would she then be rid of Elena's face? Would life appear in the dead man's eyes? But she clenched her teeth together. Holy King Olav, I call to you. Among all those in heaven, I beg you for help, for I know that you loved God's righteousness above all else. I beseech you to protect the innocent one who is in my womb. Turn God's anger away from the innocent. Turn it toward me. Amen. In the precious name of the Lord. My children are innocent, said Elena. Yet there is no room for them in a land where Christian people live. Your child was conceived out of wedlock just as my children were. You can no more demand justice for your child in the land you have strayed from than I could demand it for mine. Holy Olav, I beg for mercy nevertheless. I beg for compassion for my son. Take him under your protection. Then I will carry him to your church in my bare feet. I will bring my golden crown to you and place it on your altar. If you will help me, amen. Her face was as rigid as stone. She was trying so hard to keep herself calm, but her body trembled and shuddered as she knelt there and was married to Erlon. And now Kristen sat beside him in the high seat at home and sensed everything around her as a mere illusion in the delirium of fever. There were musicians playing on harps and fiddles in the high loft. Singing and music came from the room below and from out in the courtyard. A reddish glow from the fire outside was visible whenever servants came through the door, carrying things back and forth. Everyone stood up around the table. She stood between her father and Erland. Her father announced in a loud voice that now he had given his daughter Kristen to Erland Nikolausen as his wife. Erland thanked his father-in-law and all the good people who had gathered to honor him and his wife. Then they told Kristen to sit down, and Erland placed his wedding gifts in her lap. Sira Eirik and Sir Munan Bardsson unrolled documents and read off a list of their property. The groomsmen stood by with spears in hand, pounding the shafts on the floor now and then during the reading, and whenever gifts or money bags were placed on the table. The tabletops and trestles were removed. Erland led her out onto the floor and they danced. Kristen thought, our bridesmaids and groomsmen are much too young for us. Everyone who grew up with us has moved away from this region. How can it be that we have come back here? You seem so strange, Kristen, whispered Erland as they danced. I'm afraid for you, Kristen.
Aren't you happy?
They went from building to building and greeted their guests. All the rooms were filled with many candles, and people were drinking and singing and dancing everywhere. Kristen felt as though everything was so unfamiliar at home, and she had lost all sense of time. The hours and the images flowed around each other, oddly disconnected. The autumn night was mild. There were fiddlers in the courtyard, too, and people dancing around the bonfire. They shouted that the bride and groom must also do them the honor, so Kristen danced with Erland in the cold, dew-laden courtyard. That seemed to wake her up a little, and her head felt clearer. Out in the darkness, a light band of fog hovered over the rushing river. The mountains stood pitch black against the star-strewn sky. Erland led her away from the dance and crushed her to him in the darkness beneath an overhanging gallery.
I haven't even told you that you're beautiful. So beautiful and so lovely. Your cheeks are as red as flames.
He pressed his cheek against hers as he spoke.
Kristen, what's the matter?
I'm just so tired. So tired, she whispered in reply.
Soon we'll go in and sleep, said the bridegroom, looking up at the sky.
The Milky Way had swung around and was stretching almost due north and south.
Do you know, we've never spent a whole night together except that one time when I slept with you in your bedchamber at Skog.
Sometime later, Sera Eirik shouted across the courtyard that now it was Monday, and then the women came to lead the bride to bed. Kristen was so tired that she hardly had the energy to resist, as she was supposed to do for the sake of propriety. She let herself be led out of the loft by Fru Asshild and Hiri of Skog. The groomsmen stood at the foot of the stairs with burning tapers and drawn swords. They formed a circle around the group of women and escorted Kristen across the courtyard, up to the old loft. The women removed her wedding finery piece by piece and laid it aside. Kristen noticed that at the foot of the bed was draped the violet-blue velvet dress that she would wear the next day, and on top of it lay a long, finely pleated snow-white linen cloth. This was the wimple that married women wore and that Erland had brought for her. Tomorrow she would bind up her hair in a bun and fasten the cloth over it. It looked so fresh and cool and reassuring. Finally, she stood before the bridal bed in her bare feet, bare-armed, dressed only in the ankle-length golden-yellow silk shift. They had placed the crown on her head again. The bridegroom would take it off when the two of them were alone. Ronfrid placed her hands on her daughter's shoulders and kissed her cheek. The mother's face and hands were strangely cold, but she felt sobs bursting deep inside her breast. Then she threw back the covers of the bed and invited the bride to sit down. Kristen obeyed and leaned back on the silk pillows propped up against the headboard. She had to tilt her head slightly forward because of the crown. Fru Asshild pulled the covers up to Kristen's waist, placed the bride's hands on top of the silk coverlet, and arranged her shining hair, spreading it out over her breast and her slender, naked arms. Then the men led the bridegroom into the loft. Munan Bardsson removed Erland's gold belt and sword. When he hung it up on the wall above the bed, he whispered something to the bride. Kristen didn't understand what he said, but she did her best to smile. The groomsman unlaced Erland's silk clothing and lifted the long, heavy garment over his head. He sat down in the high-backed armchair, and they helped him take off his spurs and boots. Only once did the bride dare to look up and meet his eyes. Then everyone wished the couple good night. The wedding guests left the loft. Last to leave was Lavrans Björgolfsson, who closed the door to the bridal chamber. Erland stood up and tore off his underclothes and threw them onto the bench. He stood before the bed, took the crown and silk ribbons from Kristen's hair, and placed them over on the table. Then he came back and climbed into bed. And kneeling beside her on the bed, he took her head in his hands, pressing it to his hot, naked chest as he kissed her forehead all along the red band that the crown had made. She threw her arms around him and sobbed loudly. Sweet and wild, she felt that now it would all be chased away, the terror, the ghostly visions. Now, at last, it was just the two of them again.